Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you doing, man?
I'm doing great.
It's been a while since we've had you.
It has been a while, yes. It's been quite a long time.
So you and I were talking before the holidays, and you had this great idea that you were sort of like, you know, wanted to talk to people who aren't necessarily language designers and get to know them. Tell me what you're thinking. What's going on?
Yes, so we've been doing expert to expert for a while now.
Yes.
But what I really wanted to do is to show people, you know, the guys and girls inside Microsoft that actually check in code, that have their hands on the keyboards, that have their hands in the dirt every day,
excellent,
that build our products.
Absolutely.
And you know, to give you a little touch, the Channel 9 viewers, a little touch of, you know, the real world here at Microsoft.
Excellent.
And so that's this new series.
Cool.
Checking in with Eric Meyer.
Yeah.
And what I will do is I will visit guys like Mike, mm-hmm, who are writing our products, and chat about them, about their work, about their passion, how they entered the field, what are they working on, and all kind of other interesting stuff.
Perfect. So let's go. Mike's been on before, but let's
yes,
go.
Yes. So Mike, introduce yourself to the viewers.
Hey, I'm Mike Sampson, one of the lead developer architect guys on Channel 9. I realized just now that this is the exact same shirt I've worn in like 3 Channel 9 interviews. So I promise you I own other shirts. But I wrote probably 70-80% of the back end of Channel 9 and all the attendant services and other things that people don't see that run on the back end.
So this is like a kind of a recursive Channel 9 interview. Yes. So, Mike, can you tell us why or how did you kind of get into computer science?
So it started when I was a kid. We had an IBM PC Junior.
Wow.
That was our first computer, and I had BASIC on a cartridge. And I remember I would write, I could go to the public library and get these little, like, learn to program books that had, like, these little colorful pictures of, like, this is what RAM is, and this is what ROM is in your CPU and stuff. And I'd come home and write programs with my brother. And then after a while, we got our computer upgraded. We got our hands on VB. I want to say it was 5. And we didn't know how to, we were just making forms with buttons and hooking them up to stuff and doing crazy things. And then I didn't do much in high school, but then around college, I joined a program at my school that was all about students working with professors to help do a technology project. And a lot of it was websites, but some of it was programming stuff. So I did that. I worked in the IS department building some internal web apps and stuff. And then I did 2 internships at Microsoft. My first is in an SDET, doing tests and tooling. I came back for another internship as a dev because I was good at writing the tools part, not so much writing the test part, but that's okay. Came back as a dev and then worked on the BB team for a couple years and then came over here and worked with these guys in Channel 9.
Good. Yeah. So I hear this this kind of story quite often. I mean, it's very similar to my story. I started out on a TRS-80 with BASIC, but for me, my friend tried to teach me programming, and I think I've told this story a million times. But whenever I hear somebody like you, I remind myself of that. He wrote like dim x equals x plus 1. And I just couldn't understand how that was possible. And so that's how I got into computer science, via BASIC as well. So one of the things that is, if you look at current, you know, laptops and all the computers, they are getting so close. So how can kids, you know, learn to program these days? Do you have any kind of, you know, concerns or ideas about that?
It's tricky. I think there's actually a lot in my history, and I think that you can do today when you look at games. For example, I think I've actually told the story on Channel 9 before. I played a game called Rocky's Boots, which was all about what I didn't realize at the time, logic gates and building circuits and building chips. And so when I got to hardware in college, I was like, oh, this is that game I played when I was 6. I think there's a lot of, and maybe this is a little dated, there's a lot of games these days like where you get things like you get a Half-Life, one of the first-person shooters, all those other games that play, and even it looks like Little Big Planet and other games on PS3 that are all about kind of user-created content, building mods, all that kind of stuff, and it gives you kind of a really good place to start, where when I'm IBM PC Junior, I could print text on the screen, that was sweet, but that's because that was a really advanced computer back then.
Yes.
These days, you need something a little more kind of responsive, and I think there's a lot to be said for games out there that are a lot more about content creation. There's a great game out there called Minecraft now, which is all about just construction and building, and someone's there are certain you build things out of rocks and stuff. There are certain rocks people figure out that'll conduct electricity, and people build circuits out of them, and then you can build all kinds of other complex things out of that. So there's a lot of kind of gateway activities that then you go, okay, well, that's what I can do with the tools that are here. What can I do with more tools? And I think the web then kind of becomes another great way to jump out, to kind of write a, if you have a blog, write a WordPress plugin, or try maybe writing a little app for your, for your phone or iPad or Windows Phone 7 or, Android or whatever you want. And I think that there's a lot of space in kind of these little programs that are on these kinds of devices people have, where you can kind of jump in with both feet and give it a try.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you mentioned Minecraft. My 7-year-old son is very into that.
Ah, yes.
And it also looks very 80s, right? It has
the
8-bit graphics kind of feel. So.
Oh, yeah. My brother is an absolute Minecraft addict. I know sometimes I'll call him on the weekends. I was like, what are you doing? He's like, yeah, sorry, I didn't wake up till noon. I was playing Minecraft, and I looked up, and it was 4 in the morning. But he builds all kinds of stuff, and it's kind of a fun, because it's not really a directed experience. It's go out into the world and chop down a tree, and you've got about 6 or 7 hours, but then the monster's going to come get you. So maybe the first day you dig a hole, and the second day you build a castle, and then you start to kind of look and go, I bet I can make a really cool one of these, and you figure out how the water flow works, and there's all kinds of, it's a lot like kind of programming, where it's, when you start off, you just kind of want to get something done, but if the interest, if you really got the passion for it and the interest, then you start to kind of look at the world and go, I wonder if I could do this, and you don't really know how something works, and so you have to learn how it works, and it gives you, it's a good hands-on. That's the thing I like most, I think, about programming, is looking at something and going, well, I can figure out how that works. That code was written by humans. I'm a human. I can figure this out.
Okay, so you are attracted to the kind of computational thinking.
And ways of kind of, I like the elegance. When you have a problem that seems really, it seems complicated, it seems hard to work with, but then you can come up with a solution that is very simply expressed, is very elegant, and can kind of, through just its basic structure, just kind of handle all your special cases, and things can just kind of flow and work. When you can write that kind of perfect, that one-liner function that's maybe a little hard to see into, but you write it and you're like, and it just handles everything.
So do you have a concrete example of that from your work on Channel 9?
There are some good ones. And actually, I probably thank you for a lot of them, because a lot of them are Link. Link has kind of taken over my programming style. What's a good one? I really like the way that users get authenticated, and the way that flow happens, is because it's so... I have all these different... There's different ways you can sign into Channel 9. You can sign up your Live ID. Some people still have a username and password. There's a couple others, an API key way that some of our internal apps use. There's another basic authentication that another app uses. All of those they all run at the same time, and then there's just kind of this, they all filter down, and there's this simple app, this simple piece of code that you can just look at all of them and decide kind of hierarchically, basically, who you are based on... kind of the precedence of each of these different modules. And so each one of these pieces is very simple. There's one guy whose simple job is to look into a look at the sorted collection, take the first thing off, see if you can find a user, and then kind of move down the stack. All these other guys are just simply concerned with doing their job, but because of the way they all plug into the pipeline at different points, they all kind of just flow together. And I really like that kind of idea of, you have a bunch of small pieces, they have one job that they're focused on, but then you can orchestrate them and connect them in a very kind of simple way, such that everybody's got a very simple job, but together we get something awesome. There's a great example I read in a book once that compared it to a traffic light. When you pull up to a traffic light, the traffic light doesn't tell every car to stop and control its speed and control where to go. The traffic light simply sends a signal, you can go, and then each individual actor makes its choice and moves, and then complex behavior kind of emerges. And I think that's a much more interesting and kind of fruitful way to design, rather than kind of a very top-down, let's control every little thing approach.
Okay, so that sounds very, very interesting, and I don't know if people have seen here the logo, which in some sense is, and I use that example of Legos, these modern Legos, quite often, because that is in some sense the opposite approach of compositionality, right? Here you're building one specific thing that looks good, but you can only build one thing. Whereas what you're saying is that where beauty comes from, if you have like simple things that you can compose in unexpected ways to solve a problem.
Exactly. And it's so much easier when something breaks down or there's a problem, because it's usually either someone's doing their small job wrong or I've composed it wrong, and kind of there are different solutions to each of them, but it's much simpler than the kind of this command control system where, like, if I get halfway through building a wing and then I go to snap it on and realize I'm missing a part, I'm like, oh, when was I supposed to put that? And you got to kind of then troll back through all the steps and figure out, when was I supposed to put that on? Where is that supposed to go? But with kind of, with simple pieces, it's like, well, your job is only, of course you didn't know that you had to redirect someone to live ID or whatever. That's not your job. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of go into a quest of like, okay, well then who gets the new responsibility? And it's kind of that fun, it's like you're trying to break down the problem and find these natural little scenes and stuff. And that's kind of the, and when you get it right, when you don't get it right, you get frustrated because you go back and go, oh, this object's doing too much, I should break it down. But when you do get it right, it kind of, things just seem to work. And when they break, you know why they're broken, and you can fix them quickly, and it's an easy system to keep in balance.
So when I think of Gentle 9 and how that kind of works in the back end, and you mentioned Link, how do you debug a system like that? And because there's live users and whatever, so how, when something goes wrong, yeah, how do you kind of find what's wrong?
It's
how
tricky.
Do you fix it?
It's tricky.
Without taking the site down.
So we have, Shelly runs in Azure, and so we have Azure Diagnostics, and that logs everything that's going to the Windows event logs, a bunch of custom stuff from us, and all that. And so I can, and I have a, we have a diagnostics portal that I use that aggregates all that together. So usually if someone goes, I went to the admin, I tried to save my post, and I got an error message, I go, okay, well, I look at when they sent it, the portal site lags a little bit, I go and I say, okay, well, let's set the time range, let's see what went to the event logs, see if I got a handled exception, and check for those and stuff. And if I can usually then kind of figure out, okay, I think I know where it is, because of the way I've got the site set up, it's really easy for me in Visual Studio just to change the config. I've got like debug and release, but I've got another one that's called debug with Azure, which runs the site on my local machine, but for database access goes out to the Azure database. And so I can then, because I've got the debug code, log in as that user, pull up that entry, and do it all right on my local machine without and run the real code that's live, and then test fixes, all that kind of stuff. But do it against the live data, because sometimes it could be that the data's gotten to a state that maybe I didn't expect, or some external tool we have a bunch that work with it maybe left something in a half initialized state that's breaking the site, or I can go and take a look at that. And that bug actually ended up being like a weird regular expression bug. We wanted to allow certain characters, and we fixed a couple regular expressions but missed a couple others. And so the input was saying, oh yeah, that's fine, and like it got to some lower layer, and it's like, whoa, you can't put that character in there, and then just kind of it's fixing the disconnect ended up being the tricky part there. But yeah, so that's kind of usually the advantage of being able to kind of take the site as it is and run it locally on my machine against live data, I think, helps, is my primary debugging mechanism. There's sometimes where I get thornier bugs where I haven't had to use the remote desktop feature in Azure yet, but it's on my list, we'll see. but we also have, like, we also sometimes just push it up to staging, and then, because if it's something where that's happening only in Azure, then just try to bang on it there.
And do you guys have pagers when, because if Channel 9 is viewed all over the world, so if you're in your sleeping and maybe somewhere in different parts of the world somebody might have problems, do they kind of call you out of bed? Or?
The only couple of
Or is Charles responsible?
Charles asleep.
So you have Visual Studio installed? you figure it out. A couple of times, usually we don't. Usually it's, we don't, we're important and reviewed all over the world, but at the same time, whenever I'm joking with the content team, I was like, well, it's not like we're taking people credit cards and we're taking their money. It's not like we're, and so there's a, we're not, I would say mission critical. We're very important, and we definitely take stability very seriously. Mm-hmm. Usually the couple of times where I'll be up late waiting for certain events, when we're doing around like kind of timed announcements, like we want this to go live at 8 a.m. East Coast, and I'm like, well, I'm up at 5 a.m. I'll take a look at it. Or when we're doing things around PDC or Mix or that kind of stuff. Those are generally like the frantic call, rush to a laptop kind of moments. But we're getting those less and less now. I think that the rebuilding the back end and focusing a lot more on stability before we released helps us kind of. We haven't really had many of those moments. what on the new site, which I think is really good because it's a lot more sleep for me. That's always nice.
Yeah. So another question is like if you look at the structure of the Channel 9 backend, there are several things. There's searching for content. There's the comment sections and so on. Can you explain for our viewers a little bit how those work? Can you drill down into the kind of various components?
Everything is in, or almost everything, is in a SQL Azure database. I have a pretty simple model of, we use ASP.MVC. And so a request comes in, it gets matched to a route. Then you get assigned to a controller, and that's where all the business logic is going to happen. Usually if you're doing a GET request, like you want to see a page, the controller will execute a bunch of queries. Each one of those queries is an object. And so I have a class that's called entries by tag. And so if you're viewing a tag page, it'll go execute that query. That then runs through the NHibernate ORM, goes out to SQL Azure, comes back. The controller then collects all the information that's needed, puts it into a view model, passes that to the view. So we use the Spark view engine from Louis Desjardins, who now works for us. We then render HTML and send it down. The search is actually an interesting one. Our search provider, we actually, if you're viewing this on the website, right click and say view source, and you can follow along. There's a bunch of meta tags in the header that are all a bunch of metadata we give to Bing, where we tell it things like this page is entry ID some GUID, and here are the tags on it, and here are the people who are in it, and we give it a bunch of extra information. And then on our search page, we turn around and query Bing, when you filter things like show me all the entries, we then get the data back from Bing, and when Bing gives us the results, it gives us all that metadata we stuffed in there. So then we can go, oh, your entry ID is this, and we can make sure that the URL is canonical, and we'll put like preview image, and we can put all kinds of extra stuff in there. So we can, Bing actually is the engine that does the real searching, but we do a bunch of work to make sure it's got lots and lots of information so that when we get the results back, we can give you a really nice render, but also that we can do kind of very pinpoint searches and filter by specific things all by using the Bing API.
Okay, and so Bing indexes the sites, kind of just, do you do anything special for that, or is it just like, the robot comes every night and crawls the Channel 9 site?
Yeah, the robot comes on. I think we called the Ping service for a while, but just on our own little measurements, it ended up kind of not helping us as well.
Okay.
But search engine optimization and putting lots of metadata in there, I think, is really helpful. We get, I would say, about half of our traffic comes from people coming from a search engine. And but there's a lot of, I think the best example I heard was, there was an eHome video we did when that eHome, or however you're supposed to pronounce it.
Exactly.
Whenever that came out. So that got announced, and later that day, if you search for it on Google, the Channel 9 video about it was like the first result. And that's because we get a lot of links from other people, and we're really good about offering up a site. Like, our sitemap actually is an interesting thing that Duncan did this for the last Channel 9 and brought it forward. When you come and get our sitemap, we give you a list of all these pages, and then we basically render you a very search engine friendly version of every entry in the entire site. And we actually even cache the individual pages of all the links. And so that way when a search engine comes to see us, we give you kind of just on a smorgasbord, here's all of our content categorized and everything you can do. And so it's really easy for search engines to troll us and find everything they want. And that then translates into good listings. Also having great content, of course, and getting lots of external links. And so, that's something that's really important that we make sure that we do. But it's cool because it has a huge payoff that actually ends up being not too much work for us because it's a couple of headers in the top of or a couple of tags in the head.
And so you also mentioned that you were using NHibernate.
Yes.
Can you explain why you made that choice?
So we made the call to use NHibernate, it's coming up on, I guess, 2 years ago. This was before .NET 4 shipped. And so I was choosing between Link to SQL, which I had used on the back end for VisitMix and what eventually became Oxite, Entity Framework 3.5, and Hibernate 2.0. The biggest thing that I think that kind of tipped me in favor of and Hibernate was caching. It has a lot of integrated caching providers where you can do, both it and Entity Framework have a first-level cache, which will, inside a single session, save you entries that you've seen before. It also has a second-level cache, which will cache not only queries, but it'll also cache individual entities. And so if you need entry 1, 2, 3, 4, it exists in second level cache and pull it out of there. Okay. And there are some samples that let you do it with Entity Framework, but they were still a little immature, and they're not as baked in through and through. They don't have as much information, and so they necessarily can't be as sophisticated. And also, Entity Framework 3.5 didn't have the code first idea
yes.
yet
yeah.
and stuff. And so I think it was just a matter of looking at kind of what I had on the table when I had to make the call, and I think I never was winning. I think that with the possible exception of caching, I think that Entity Framework has done a really good job of catching up. But
so is that like a programming style that you often use, where you kind of look around, see what are the materials in the room, and use that to kind of get your job done?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of there are a lot of times where it's much more beneficial to lean on the library when you can, because sometimes there's kind of a trust you can place in the library, where it's like, this is something that's been out there for a certain number of years. It anticipates certain problems I may not know I even have yet. It can handle certain strange cases. I can lean on that expertise and get a lot of value out of it. There's sometimes when that bites you. There's sometimes when you lean on a library thinking it's going to be smart, and then after you work with it for a little bit, then you start to run into problems. Then you dig in, you realize, oh, it's not going to handle this, or you realize your needs are different, and you need to be able to handle certain cases, and the library's not exposing it to you. And there are a couple of definitely things that, like, in Channel 9 that we wrote, or like all the authentication stuff is done by handling just the raw IIS events. I don't plug into like ASP.NET membership or anything like that, because that was actually another tech decision. I looked at it and I was like, well, ASP.NET membership talks about things like email addresses and usernames and passwords, and you can write providers that don't lean on those things, and that's what the old Channel 9 did. But I feel like I'm kind of putting a square hole in a round peg. Like, it didn't really fit right. So I was like, well, our needs are simple, we understand them, let's write around. And so I think that's kind of the deciding line, where it's, am I going to spend 3 weeks writing this custom authentication provider, or am I going to spend 3 weeks battling ASP.NET membership, which doesn't really fit for my scenario, and thankfully I can replace it. And that's the measure of a good framework, I think, where I can take out pieces that I want, put in pieces I do, and everything keeps going.
And so how big is the content that is on Channel 9? So, and in particular, does it fit in one SQL Azure database, or do you have to do sharding or more complex queries to spread your content over multiple?
That's actually interesting. We've been looking at sharding less from a database size perspective, but more just kind of a performance perspective. Like, SQL Azure, because of its nature of being scalable, has limits on how hard you can hit it. And we've got tools that do, I've got tools that all the view tracking is done by web trends and by parsing logs we get from our CDN. And that has to get pushed in the Channel 9 database. And I had to make sure I tuned those queries and the frequency which that background service runs such that I didn't overload the SQL database. And then if you take up too much, the SQL Server runs out of room, it goes, okay, well, who's the biggest person? I'm going to start dropping their connections. It was us a lot. And so, because we got in touch with the dev support team, which anybody can do. It's actually they're really helpful. And they were like, yeah, you're taking up too much space. You're getting dropped. And so we had to tune the site such that we don't put too much pressure on it. So a lot of the sharding or replication of things we've looked at have been much more about being able to handle more concurrent connections. And I've seen that a lot in, there are some people who have, like, I have a 16 terabyte database, and who are doing kind of that, like, really deep data analysis that need to move to sharding and stuff in SQL Azure. But I think for a lot of people, it's much more about managing how hard you're hitting the database. And so that the couple of attempts we've had to look at sharding have been mostly based on performance. We've kind of put it on the back burner for now because performance seems to be okay. As long as we keep an eye on things and don't write tools that are ill-behaved, we're generally okay when it comes to that perf stuff. But it's something that's been on the table. Also, moving over to table storage as a non-relational store has been something that was always kind of a pet project of mine for a long time. Of like, I think I can do it. I think I can do it. Every time I think I've kind of got it, and the trade-off ends up not being worth it, and I kind of back away for a while and put it on the back burner and see if my brain will come up with something when I'm not realizing it. But
you're using SQL Azure. So have you also looked at the other storage mechanisms that Azure has and, look at the trade-off there?
The log importing service that I mentioned doesn't run on SQL Azure at all, except at the very end when it pushes the views in the channel line. That actually runs off of blobs, queues, and tables, all of them. the log importing process is basically the logs we put up on some server, we FTP them down, we un-gzip them, run them through log parser, figure out all the numbers. Then I have to kind of correlate, foo.mp4 with this entry ID, and then credit the view, total up all the views for that day, credit them, and then that's actually stored in this giant table in table storage, mm-hmm. which is entry ID, day, and then views for like web views, downloads, RSS views, feature views of the homepage, that kind of stuff. And then I have another process that aggregates that table into total views and views this week and views this month and pushes over to 9. And that's all coordinated with queues. Like when I do the aggregation, I do it. I think I have 3 nodes. Each one will do 20 at a time, and they'll get a lock in blob storage and get the list of all entry IDs and all channel line, break it into 20 entity blocks, and then queue a message for each one, put the list in blob storage, and then I have threads listening to that queue and pulling things out and stuff. And so that's all in Azure storage. I think I tried to move forums on channel line over to table storage,
okay.
but they're really relational. That's the thing. The tricky part about 9 is 9 is a lot about pivoting data, like one thing, 4 different ways. Like view it by tag, view it by author, view it by show, and that was always tricky to get table storage. I want to do it though. I really want to do it, but it's.
So and you mentioned that you're using queues and so on. So can you explain the architecture? Because what kind of roles do you use,
sure.
And so on? And do you kind of, when you get a request, do you spin up new worker roles and so on? And
what we do for the queues is I have I use this pattern that from talking to some of the Azure guys, it works pretty well. Is where I have one role that does 3 or 4 different things. It's just doing them all kind of in parallel. They're all gated by queues. And so the worker role that does log importing actually will do, it'll download from FTP, it'll parse it, and it'll push it to table storage. It just does it it's just waiting on 3 different threads, listening to 3 different queues. And when this role completes, it puts a message in the queue, and then any one of the roles can get it. Usually we end up, we don't need to scale that much because we have a pretty predictable workload. It's, we get one log file a day from each of our 2 CDNs, we download it, we parse it, we're good,
mm-hmm.
It can go to sleep till tomorrow. There are some times, though, where we'll change the way we record views or realize that we, smooth streaming, for example, we just added that field and I needed to update the log importer, so I needed to go back and rerun a bunch of logs,
mm-hmm.
and so I have a little app that I can go in and, check a bunch of days and have it, okay, so rerun these days, and it'll re-queue the message to start in the middle of the pipeline to start parsing it. And when I was doing that was going to basically bog up the system for 2 or 3 days if I was running it with my 2 small rules. So I went into the portal and cranked it up to 6 or 7, let it run through over lunch and come back and turn it back down to 2. And so architecturally, it's almost kind of like I've got a... It's an asynchronous workload. I've got
mm-hmm.
basically a bunch of steps I'm going through. It's just that at certain points in the process, rather than continuing on that same machine, I put a message in a queue and then just kind of stay in this loop. But there's another thread in the same process that's looping at the next thing and that's looping at the next one. And I just finished writing this when all the announcements of async came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time I was watching that video, I kept hitting my desk going, I want this right now. This would make my life so much easier. Because there was a lot of talk of it's really hard to write async code that doesn't look like you've hit it with a hammer and
mm-hmm.
scattered the pieces
yes,
all
yep.
over. And and error handling's everywhere and stuff. And that's basically what the biggest problems I had getting this thing up. It's taking 2 weeks I worked on it for about 2 weeks, and 2 days were spent getting the business logic and the things, and then a week and 3 days were spent figuring out the different asynchrony and the multi-threading and where's this error going to happen and where's this error going to happen and all that. And so that stuff's still hard.
And so is this something that you're planning to rewrite using the new features?
Absolutely, if I can. It's definitely something that as we move forward with different analysis tools and database and stuff. It's the log importer is something that's going to have to get revved as we move to if we use a new reporting system and that kind of stuff. And it's definitely something that when I look at it, I'm like, it works, but it works kind of like I've patched it up and it's working, but it's held together with duct tape. Like it's whenever I go in there, there's always a sense of okay, don't touch anything, and I'm kind of trying to get my head back in the space because it's so hard. It's so hard to read it. Like when I look at a class on Channel 9, I know where everything is
mm-hmm.
because you know, it's a bunch of little objects that all have their jobs, but to do the async stuff and to do it kind of I use a task parallel library to, you know, do parallel processing and all that kind of stuff. To get all that working and to get the performance I want, I have to kind of write this kind of squirrely stuff. And so it's one of those, it's like a little nagging on my head. Like, it's one of those things where I want to go back and I want to clean up the mess.
Yeah. Continuation passing style is something, you know, for compilers to output, not
yes.
for humans
yes.
to write.
Yes, I love all those Eric Lippert articles, and I was like, and then when it got to the end with async, I'm like, I'm really glad this ended with, and now you won't have to write this anymore, but in case you decompile it, this is what the code is.
Yes.
That made my life a lot easier. But no, yeah, that's definitely something. Taking advantage of some of the features in .NET 4 and beyond is something that, because we still run on 3.5 right now, but the .NET 4.0 upgrade is one of those other things that's like high on my list of, once you have time, this is something you should really do.
And So that is another question that I had, is like, how do you kind of, you know, divide your time between, you know, upgrading the site or kind of, you know, cleaning up the code and adding new features? Because I guess there's always like a constant pressure to add new features.
Yeah.
But obviously you want to also, you know, make sure that your code kind of, you know, stays up to date and you're
yeah.
kind of, you know, fixing it up. So how do you kind of make those decisions?
Usually it ends up working out pretty well, because whenever we get a new feature in, there's some pieces that are really kind of deep back-end stuff. Like, it's things like reworking authentication or something like that. But then there's other things that are kind of, they're still back-end, but they're more kind of repeating a pattern. Like, we wanted to add, when Coding for Fun came online, we added like Coding for Fun projects, and so we needed like a couple of queries to support the page, like get all the projects, get the most recent project, get one project and stuff. Well, a lot of those are very, you know, they're just kind of iterations on the query to get all entities, to get all entries, to get all tags, all that kind of stuff. And so those are things that are more easily shared between the members of the team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have Joff is our, he's a huge front end guy. He'll dabble in the back of the end, but he's much more of like JavaScript HTML guy. Kara, I think, is kind of can straddle that line pretty well. Like, she can do some of that back end stuff, and she can come and do some of the deep back end stuff with me, but she's also really at home on the client front end. And so if we get a feature that is a pretty decent amount of front end, like what Coding for Fun was, and the back end isn't super deep, there's like a couple of big decisions to make and a couple of things right at the beginning, but then once that's done, I'm kind of finished. Then they can go and work on that, and then I can go. Then that kind of frees me up to spend more time on some of the deeper back end stuff. Like, while they were working on that, I was adding support for Windows Live Writer, so people who are authoring on Channel 9 could use Windows Live Writer to write their posts and things like that. And that ended up being some pretty, because that had some authentication implications, because it's an app authenticated
mm-hmm.
with 9, and it had some interesting implications of API, because it uses Atom Pub and all that kind of stuff. And so that ended up being something that was pretty deep. And actually caused me to clean up a bunch of other places of code, because there were places where I assumed that you were going to be a website and suddenly
yeah.
you weren't anymore, and I had to clearly delineate assumptions between, you know, the service that saves an entry and the pieces that feed it, because now there's a whole other pipeline that comes down, and he was inadvertently depending on some things that were happening here, and so I had to kind of make those explicit and separate them out and stuff. And so I'm a big believer in letting kind of new features push your cleanup, because if there's something in the architecture that's not perfect but okay, but nothing else ever leans on it, and there's no new features that kind of push it or bend it a different way, then you probably don't need to clean it up that much. But like, if there's something that seems pretty solid, but as soon as a new feature comes in, is bending and twisting and snapping in a way you didn't anticipate, then that's where your architecture work is really needed. And that's
yeah.
kind of the, I try, and there's some, I mean, you know, the log importer is messy and just messy, and I want to fix it just because it's, I want it to be elegant. But usually I try to, I have a saying where it's, we'll always, whenever we want to add an extra layer of abstraction, I'm always like, let's wait till there's two things that want to do it. Once there are two things that want to do it, we can see, you know, which things are specific and which things are general. Until then, we're just guessing at what's general, and who knows, you know, we may be wrong. We may decide, like, oh, we got to pull all these things out of an interface, and then we make the second one, we realize this interface doesn't help it at all, and we have to make it its own, and you get all
yeah.
kinds of...
Yeah, so my rule is actually three, that you need
oh,
to
three.
Have three examples before you can abstract.
Maybe
you can even push back harder.
Well, that's true. I guess Coding for Fun was pretty specific, so maybe I am waiting for example number three before I build some sort of like because when Coding for Fun came out, it was like, when you go to a page, it's got like a little bit of branding and stuff. And I had this idea of like, what if I had this concept of like a brand, and like an entry could be in a brand, and like the brand could overwrite certain things. And I was like, you know what, this is really complicated, and I don't know if it's going to work. Once we have two brands, but now maybe I'm only for three.
Yes.
Because that's the thing, is you may think like, you know, well, once I come up with this brand idea, we're going to have brands coming out of the woodwork. But then you get two, and then you never get a third, and then you spend all this time kind of building this complex thing, and then nobody shows up.
Yes, and that's often like, you know, a bad sign when you have an interface and there's only one type that implements the interface. So another question is like, you know, how do you prioritize the features? So is there any kind of feedback, or do you do like A/B testing where you're kind of trying out different features for different users on the site?
When we were in beta, a lot of the prioritization came from the Connect site. So we had like, you go to like Microsoft Connect, Gen 9ers could come in and vote on features and stuff. And I think we managed to get all of those highly rated features except one finished for release. And so that before we came out of beta, that was our primary prioritization mechanism. Since then, a lot more of it has been kind of driven by the needs of the larger team. Like Coding for Fun was a site that Dan owned, and we brought Clint over to work on, and that was we wanted to shut down the old Coding for Fun and bring it over and integrate it into Channel 9. And a lot of it was like, we want to kind of consolidate on 9 and build 9 up as the place to go for all this stuff, because we had a lot of sites before that. Now we kind of want to, and so a lot of it. The other thing, like the things that we're working on now, which I don't know when this video will air, or otherwise I'll tell you. But a lot of those are kind of driven by not really the content team, but kind of like that whole, like that side of things. And a lot of the things we try to put, but at the same time, where we have those big features like Coder for Fun, that kind of stuff, we do always want to make sure we take the time to see if we can get out like little quality of life fixes, or fixes for IE9, because a new build of IE9 will come out, and that'll interact in a weird way with our text editor. And then our front-end JavaScript guy will have to spend a couple of days staring at obfuscating JavaScript to figure out what's going wrong and fix it and stuff. But so we try to kind of find that balance of, when we see something that's really blocking people, we'll take the day or two to try to get it fixed, and we'll get it out. And thanks to the way packaging works for Azure and deployment and stuff, we can really quickly, once we have a fix checked in, package it up and get it out. And so that's one of the nice things about working on a website, is that when something breaks and we see it, we can fix it and get it out. That's nice.
Yeah. And you're the back-end guy, but you mentioned IE9, so how do you guys make the site work for, you know, different browsers and people that use different devices to watch Channel 9? Because I see that, you know, you have the video formats in like many, or you have many different video formats to accommodate for that, but do you do anything special when you build the site to make it, you know, friendly to different browsers?
A lot of it is that Joff and Kara have almost every browser in the world installed on their machine. And Joff has at his desk an XP machine, a Vista machine, and a Windows 7 machine. He's got multiple versions of IE. He's got Firefox, Chrome, all that. I know Kara's got a whole bunch of them. My Windows 7 taskbar is just a little kind of little browser section of four or five browsers. And a lot of it, and we also have a lot of devices. Like we have iPads, iPhones, Windows Phone 7s, Android phones, all that kind of stuff. And so a lot of it's just, we just actually physically acquire the devices and test them out. But a lot of it's also just that I think Kara and Joff really deeply care about the structure of the markup and the CSS and the JavaScript, such that it's well-formed, it's standardized, and it's done in such a way that the site works on a phone. Like I've been to the site on my phone. Even I had a Sidekick that had a pretty, you know, gnarly browser. And the site works really well as is on the phone, mostly just because they built the thing, something that will, you know, things will slide and flow and lay out, and everything can just work, and we don't really need to have like an app or a mobile site. I mean, that would be nice because you get a full richer experience, but the site just works. The video formats actually end up a lot being user feedback, because we'll get mails from people that's like, hey, I want to view this on my phone, but I don't want to download 4 gigs. And we're like, okay, well, let's see if we can make it smaller. This, or, you know, I want to see this MP4, and I want to put it on like my iPhone, or like I think someone was trying to put it on like an iPod Nano or whatever. And we're like, I don't know why you want to watch a video that big with code on it, but you're right, an MP4 that big is completely wasted on that thing. So let's make a little smaller MP4, and you know, smooth streaming and all that kind of stuff. It's a lot of it's just kind of when we hear feedback from people, they're like, yeah, I use this device, and this is pretty terrible, and we think, but we go, that is pretty terrible. Let's see if we can fix that for you. And so,
because that is interesting. Whenever there's some problem with whatever video format, right? That's the first thing when people start to have comments on.
Absolutely.
Yes. So,
you'd be surprised how many things we do because somebody sends Charles an email or somebody goes to contact us and says, "Hey, I'm trying to do this. Doesn't work." Like we're fixing a bunch of bugs with. I checked in some code the other day for authentication fixes and a bunch of stuff just because someone sent us an email and said, "Hey, this is lame." And we looked at it and we're like, "You know what? You're right. Let's fix it." And the thing is, there are lots of little things about the site that authentication can be one of them that annoy us that we're like, this is, you know, we don't like how this works, so it's bad, but like we can never really justify our time to fix it.
Yes,
but if you send us a mail and say it annoys you too, then we'll be like, well, if it's hitting users, I guess we gotta fix it, and then we'll spend some time to fix it. But we'll be surprised. It's hard to see from the outside like how much I think feedback can drive what we do. And I'm not just talking about like channel editing. We saw this a lot on Visual Studio and stuff. Like, there's a hearing about the way, and I think Entity Framework may say a great example of this too. Hearing about how what we do is received and the problem people have directly then folds back into what people are going to want to do next. Because, you know, I build the site and I'm passionate about it. And I'm proud of it. And if someone looks at it and says, "Well, that's broken and that sucks," like, I want to fix it. I don't want to suck. I want it to be good. Like, this is, you know, this is what I do for 8 hours a day. Like, it's important to me. I want it to be good.
Right on.
And do you guys get a lot of requests for a Channel 9 app for Windows Phone 7 or something like that?
We do. I remember the Niners were actually trying to get something together to build one. And a lot of it was, sometimes we'll get requests for an app, but that's always tricky because that's a lot of time for us. And we don't have a lot of phone development experience. The one thing we actually have done some things to help enable people, like, well, if you want to write an app, here's how to get all the, you know, here's how to get data out of Nine. We've gone and we've improved that in some places.
Okay, so that is, I don't know if you can talk about it, but suppose that like one of the viewers wants to build an app to do. And so are there any kind of, you know, restrictions where is that something that you guys would, you know, stimulate?
Oh, no. We put out all the data of the site, you can get almost all of it through RSS. You can even get lists of all the shows. I think you can get lists of all the shows. I'll check that and post it in the comments if you can. And you can, using RSS, and you can page through all the results, and you can get all that information out of RSS. That should give you pretty much everything you need. And at the bottom of the site, actually, in our footer, all of our stuff is done through one of the Creative Commons licenses.
Okay.
And if you, you can scroll down there and click on that, and that'll tell you all the rules about redistributing and everything like that. But that's the great thing, I think, about working on a site like Nine, as opposed to being something that's kind of a little more ad-driven, is that, like, we want to get you the content. We want you to see these great videos. We want you to read these blog posts. We want you to interact. And however we can get that out there, we're all, you know, if someone makes a killer Channel 9 app, that would be awesome. We would love that. Because that's, you know, that's more people being able to see our videos and that kind of stuff. And if they come to us and say, "Hey, you know, it's really hard to page through this, could you give me an API to do that?" Like, that's something we can take a look at. If it's easy, we can definitely look and see if we can expand the data we get out there and that kind of stuff. I mean,
I'd like to see people build an iPad app and an Android app, so I want people to do an Objective-C and also C++. Right, and then doing Silverlight as well.
Of course.
So, by the way, check this out. I wanted to just bring this up quickly because what you were talking about earlier, I wanted to pimp Stefan T. Labave has started his Advanced STL series.
Yes.
And it turns out that one of the posts resulted in the discovery of two bugs in the VC compiler.
Oh, wow.
Found by a customer. And if you look at those threads, there's more C++ code on there than I've seen in a long time in one place. So rock and roll. Just to go back to what you're saying about everybody across the company loves to get this feedback, especially with devs that interact. I'd love to see them interact with you about your architecture and stuff as well. You can teach people
what you're doing. Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think is why we tested all those different browsers and different platforms and things like that. Like, I remember back in the old night, we made adjustments so that our videos were running Moonlight and things like that, so people could be on Linux. Is that we want you to see our content. Nine's about, you know, if we only supported IE and we only supported Silverlight and that kind of stuff, then we'd just be preaching to people who already want to see our stuff. Like, we want you, you know, if you're coming in Firefox and you're coming in Chrome, you know, we see you in our logs, we know you're there. Come on over, it's cool. Whatever you want to see, technology is technology, and we want to talk about it. And we think we've got interesting stuff. We think it's cool.
So when I look at the kind of, you know, the size of the code, so how many lines of code ish channel 9?
I looked this up, and it's actually not that many. It's under 10,000. I want to say it's... I'll have to look, because we've actually added a bunch of features since then. I want to say it's 4,000 or 5,000. It's pretty terse.
Yes, sounds really terse.
And that's by design. I try very much to kind of delete code whenever I can. That's actually one of my favorite things. Is that
okay? That's really good, because I really love negative productivity.
Oh, I love it.
Yes, I mean, if devs remove code, I love it. That's much better than adding code.
Oh yeah, I was looking at the
day where you remove lines of code is a great day.
It was so exciting when MVC3 came out, and I was looking at the RTM feature list as I was going through feature. I was like, I'm gonna get to delete so much code. It was so great because I had a lot of the things that I was kind of building myself. They've built in, and so I'm like, I'm gonna be able to get rid of this class and this class, and then there's just so much that I can just throw away because I don't need it.
And I guess if you're going to use the async features, then you know there will be a whole lot of code, of really nasty code that you can throw away.
That's gonna be so nice. Yes. I think I've explained that feature to like 3 or 4 people because I'd say I'm so excited about it. Like, why are you so excited about it? I'm like, look at this, and I'll go up on a whiteboard and draw async. I was like, before you'd have to write this craziness, and now I can do it in like 5 lines. And that's actually the and Link was a similar thing. Once I finally kind of got it in my head, was that I can. There's so many places where you do for loops, or you're dealing with objects, you have to filter them, you're doing set relations, all that kind of stuff, where it's you know what you're doing, but the code you have to write isn't expressive of, mm-hmm. of your like one of the operators I use all the time is like I think it's except, the one where it's like, you know, take this set but then remove these items and get what's left. There's a lot of times in web posting where like I'll get like a list of tags and I've got an entry that has tags on it. And I get a new list, and I have to replace this list with this one. But I need to do different things if it's already there, if it's not, and stuff. And it's so nice to be able to kind of write that with one line and one function that says, okay, take out all these things and make a list that's the new ones, make a list that's the old ones, make a list of the ones that are the same, and then operate a list independently, as opposed to kind of writing these double nested for loops or something like that, which is doing the same thing. And even under the hood, maybe the code ends up being the same because we're doing link to objects, but. But now I can look at the code and read it, and my brain understands that I can keep going. I don't have to kind of context shift, decipher a for loop, and then come back out and go, wait, what am I doing again? Like, it's just, that's, I really like when, that's part of the reason I like small objects, is that I can get it all in my head at once, and I can still have context of the space around me. I don't have something that's so complicated that I need to clear out the rest of my brain to think about it. But then once I figure it out, I kind of lose it again. And so that's...
And the code, is that, what language do you use?
We write everything in C#, and then JavaScript and HTML, all stuff on the front end, but yeah, it's all C#. Which is funny, because Duncan and I both used to be big VB guys.
Yes, that was my question. You started out with VB.
I worked on the VB team, and actually all the managed code we wrote for Visual Studio on the VB team is in VB, and so if you double-click on properties of Visual Studio and that nice designer comes up, that's all VB. But but I don't know. It'll be interesting, I think, going forward as the languages kind of are kind of coming together a little more and kind of gaining each other's features. I think it really can come down to more of a stylistic, because there's always been a couple feature differences that it's
that
like,
is true.
You know, Instagram. And I don't know. Maybe I'll go back and have a bit of a VB renaissance.
That's our
VB
Charles
renaissance.
Well, our Charles would say, you know, you have to write it in C++.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Charles new
on the server, man.
So
or JavaScript. Or, you know, it's sort of native, but not really. Yeah.
There have been some pieces I've actually thought about. I thought to myself, like, you know, because there's a whenever you load the framework into a request on IIS, there's a bit of performance in it now. It's worth it usually, but there are a couple of places where I was like, you know, this is such a small little thing. I bet if, you know, I was like, if I could rewrite that in native code, then I wouldn't have to load the framework. And then, but then I realized that I've written C++ since intro comp side. So
you can figure it out.
So yeah, well, yeah, but.
Fair enough. But there is something to note. I mean, IIS 7 does support native code outside of the context of, you know, those leaky, you know, remember the what were they called?
The ISAPI folders.
The ISAPI folders.
Yes.
So typically had problems basically because of the, I would argue, because of the platform, not the language. But so apparently it's easier now, at least more controlled.
Yep.
So, but I remember just real quickly to talk about this because, you, of course, you watch Channel 9 videos when you have time. He was very inspired by your functional programming lecture series, and one day he told me he wanted to implement the back end in the functional language, was all excited, had a Haskell book and everything.
Well,
what happened to that?
I got my Haskell book, Real World Haskell there. That's actually what my brother got me for Christmas that year, is he got me the book from the series, and he got me Real World Haskell from around. What happened with that indeed? That ended up being it was tricky, because I started to get into monads and that kind of stuff, and then I think having not done a lot of functional programming and written a lot of kind of real world apps, I learned by doing and that kind of stuff. Like I jumped off into the deep end, and then I was like, whoa, and I backed off a little bit. It's interesting because I think from like 10,000 feet, like the web kind of looks, it looks very fun. Like HTTP looks very functional,
yes.
It feels very functional, and a lot of the things I've seen out there, I think make a lot of sense, but the difference I think I have is that I have to work in the context of my team, and
mm-hmm.
I have two people who are amazing front-end people, and they want to be in HTML, they want to be in JavaScript, and I very much see my role as the back-end guy is to not come into their world and make proclamations about what you have to do. Like, I see my job as very much whenever I have to interact with passing things down at the view, I go to them, I'm like, which one of these is easier for you and feels more natural when it comes to writing this? Because my goal, it's almost kind of like back the channel a little bit of when I was on the VB team. I want them to be as productive as possible. And I want them to be able to look at the things that they write in the view and see the HTML that's going to get outputted as clear as they possibly can. And I think that all the functional samples I looked at, and I see this a lot in some .NET stuff too. I think Razor is a little bit more like this, but some of the more alt-NET people to take it a little farther. They try to make it more like code. Like, HTML is an output. I'm going to assemble this string
mm-hmm.
functionally or programmatically in such a way and then send it to the user. And that works because those are the teams that they're on, and that's the way that they see HTML. But I have a bunch of people who write, who when it's time to make a web page, open up a text editor, and they just start typing, and they can just make it happen, and they just see it. And so I see my role to serve them, kind of trumping my...
Yeah, that makes sense. And also, I do believe that you can do a lot of functional programming without using, a functional language, right? It's often more about the ideas and the concepts that you're using.
Yeah.
And the language, that doesn't really make that much of a difference.
I actually use function currying in our route when we're registering routes, and it's in C#, so it's really ugly. But I had to call the same method over and over again, and then I needed to pass the same values for like the last four parameters.
Yes.
And I'm like, I don't want to cut and paste this. And so then like I save a func into a local variable, and then I call it.
Yeah.
And it works. I mean, it's obviously not as elegant as if I was doing it something like F# or something in Haskell, but it made my code look like the rest of the code looks a little better. Like there's some garbage up the front where I've got to like declare this massive func name, but it got the job done, and I was like. Which is why I'm glad a lot of that stuff kind of has come into C#, just like with .NET 4 and some of the dynamic stuff coming over too. I think there's a lot of, especially when you're dealing with something that's making a web page, HTML and JavaScript are a very dynamic place. And I think having a dynamic tool in the back end lets me kind of have a bridge when I'm passing them like all the data they need to render a review
mm-hmm.
or things like that. I can be a little dynamic putting it together, so when I give it to them, it's very dynamic for them to take apart and use in a way that feels natural to them, but I'm not having to bend over backwards to make it happen. I've got a little bit of language support, I can make it happen. And that's kind of, I like that because it makes that transition a little smoother.
Yes, and as you say, I think C# has plenty of features that allow you to do functional programming, dynamic programming, now async programming. And that's the thing, is when you're building like a real site like Channel 9, you often need like many of these different features and compose them together. Like in a different dimension, right? It's like it's not just components that you have to glue together, but kind of different jobs that you have to glue together.
Yeah, yeah. And I like that C# feels almost kind of like it's a language that is trying its best to be productive. And if that means that it doesn't, it can no longer be this hyper pure object oriented language that gets rid of all the functional dynamics. It's like, okay, well, people need dynamic to be productive. Let's bring dynamic in, but let's do it in a way that doesn't, rock the rest of the boat. And I like that kind of willingness to go out there and find other good ideas from other programming languages and bring them in kind of on C# terms and find a way to kind of make a little bit of harmony there. Because then it's handy because I can pick one language
mm-hmm.
and build a website that uses all these different things. and not have to, you know, marshal out to another language, or, you know, write a couple of files in F sharp, write a couple of files in VB, write some in C sharp. I can kind of, I can take C sharp and VB and write everything I need to write, which is really, it, I don't have to context switch when I change languages. It's just, there's a lot of advantages to it.
And so, what is the feature that you're working on right now? So, like, you know, what are you, what's the next thing you're going to check in? Of course, you know, if you can talk about that.
Yeah, I need to talk about it a little bit. So we had PEC content that was on GenOnline for a while, and after that, we started putting up a lot of events on other sites, and we want to kind of bring that forward a little bit more. For the mix coming up and things like that. And so the thing that I was working on, I'm working on two things. The first one. The first one is a very simple way for the people who are doing it, like organizing the event. They'll have like different sessions they're working on, titles, descriptions, all that kind of stuff. They do their work in some external tool. I think it's in a SharePoint site. But they've got the spreadsheet that they keep that's kind of like the master list of all the sessions here where they all have stuff. And that's a very natural way for them to process. All the old event sites we used to run, they would take that spreadsheet, they'd up to, you know, we had a little process that would watch an FTP server, they'd FTP it up, we'd take it, parse it, and spit it out into the database. And so I was just kind of rewriting a new tool that would take the new spreadsheet that they get for the new events and push it in GenOnline so people can view events and things like that. But the other thing I'm working on is looking at authentication and using the Azure App Fabric Access Control Service and just kind of doing some exploratory prototyping and seeing like kind of this seems interesting, what's going on over here, and that kind of stuff. And that's always really fun. And it's kind of like a new technology comes out, and I spent a day or two just kind of spelunking and figuring out, is this something we could adapt to solve a problem that we have, or things like that. So I'll get a book, I'll read it on the bus, so it'll be fun.
Nice. That's good. Cool. All right.
Well, hey, thank you, man.
Yes. That was very interesting. And, I hope that like somebody will kind of, you know, build an awesome Channel 9 app for, you know, and
if you're missing anything, send us a mail.
Exactly, and people, let's keep, you know, getting the feedback loop going with
Excellent. Yeah. Well, great, man. Thank you for doing this, Eric, and thank you again, Stampy, for taking the time out of your busy schedule.
No problem.
I thought this was an excellent pilot for this great new show.
Yes.
Checking in with Eric Meyer.
Thank you.
The people who do the real work at Microsoft. Rock and roll, brother. And in the world.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Cheers.